Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey everybody, welcome to Movie Crush, Friday Filmmaker Series, and I am very excited because I am starting off a filmmaker series with one of, well, for two reasons, because I love the Coen brothers, maybe more than any other filmmakers, and I love my guest, Ben Harrison, maybe more than any other podcaster.
Yes! In your face, other podcasters.
Well, I'm having Adam on next week, so I'll say the same thing about him. So Ben Harrison, you might recognize from previous episodes with Friendly Fire, which is his war movie podcast he does with Adam Pranica and John Roderick on the Max Fun Network. And he also does, and this is where he really made his name as a podcaster, with The Greatest Generation podcast, also on the Max Fun Network. And what else? You got another Star Trek thing you're doing, right?
Yeah, we have so there's the new Star Trek show, Star Trek Discovery, and we have a second podcast that's kind of in the Greatest Gen family, but it's called The Greatest Discovery. And that's going to be the show that covers all of the new Star Trek shows that are coming out, because there's like five different things in production now.
Oh, that's good news for you.
Yeah, it's gone from being a finite resource to an infinite resource.
Yeah, I remember talking to you and Adam about that, because I don't know that world, and I was like, aren't you guys eventually going to not have a job?
Yeah, we really painted ourselves into a corner. I mean, we started The Greatest Generation thinking it was just kind of training wheels, and we were going to like see if we enjoyed working together and then come up with a real idea.
Right.
That one caught on, and you know, when people connect with something, and I mean, I think they connected with it because we were having so much fun,
sure,
making it that they, you know, we were just like, all right, let's just do this.
Well, dude, I just subscribed to Greatest Gen. As you know, I don't know anything about Star Trek. I'm not going to watch it, but I like listening to you guys. And I figure if I can listen to Friendly Fire episodes of movies I haven't seen, then by God,
yeah,
I can certainly listen to YouTube knuckleheads talk about Star Trek.
One of my favorite kinds of listeners is the people that are like, I don't even really care that much about what you're talking about.
Yeah, this is the best. So I've done different things with these filmmaker series. Like sometimes we bounce around, but you had the idea to just kind of start at the beginning, which I think is a great move, with Blood Simple from 1984. And this is a movie that I have seen a bunch of times. Saw it for the first time in college on VHS when, you know, I worked at a super cool indie video store, and that's where I really got turned on to a lot of cool stuff, this being one of them. But, dude, I remember in 1984 when I was 13, I remember seeing – this the ad in the newspaper, in the movie section of the newspaper, and just something about those high heels and the boots and the gun of that original ad in the poster, for some reason it just stands out to me. I remember seeing it, didn't know what it was, but I was like, what's that all about?
It's a very iconic image. It's one of those, you know, it's one of those like early indie films where it was kind of in the vein of some of the things that happened in the 90s, where it pushed indie films into the mainstream a little bit,
for sure.
But like working with no budget to make a poster, like that's as good a poster as you could come up with.
Oh yeah, and like, what's your history with? Well, first of all, what's your history of this film, and then what's your history, or maybe the other way around, with the Coen brothers in general? Like, how does that figure into your life?
I mean, the Coen brothers are definitely among my favorite filmmakers out there. This is a film that I don't know as well as some of their other work, but in rewatching it, I was really delighted at how many threads I saw that they are still, you know, things that they're still interested in.
Oh man, it's all over the place.
Interrogating. Yeah, and like I read, I was trying to find it on my bookshelf, and I think it may have accidentally gone into storage at some point. But I have a book called My First Movie, and it's just a series of interviews with filmmakers, and they talk a bunch about making this movie in that book, and it was one of the most inspiring reads in the book for me, because they just it was real bootstrap, you know. They just like
I think the
anecdote that they tell is that they got a directory of like Jewish dentists in Manhattan and just kind of like cold called and went around, and like they had a little 16mm projector and they'd shot a scene or two, and they said like, hey, like we're trying to make a feature film, would you, you know, give us $8,000, and they just did that, you know, enough times to get a budget.
Yeah, did you they ended up, I think they went to Minnesota and New York and I think one other place, and you're right, there were like dentists and attorneys and these just professional people with money, and what they shot was a trailer, which you can actually watch. Have you haven't seen that?
I have not.
It's pretty cool. It's I came across some random article that linked to it. It's on Vimeo, and it's it has Bruce Campbell in it.
Cool.
He plays. You can't even really see his face.
He's in the Francis McDormand role.
Yeah, exactly. He's in the Dan Hedaya role as Marty.
Oh, wow.
But they only shoot a couple of scenes. They shoot basically like the scene, kind of recreate the scene of the car stopped in the desert. Which we'll get to that sequence, but one of the best in the movies. And Bruce Campbell stumbles out of the back and like pukes up blood. And they have some other guy playing, you know, playing the lead dude. But yeah, that was good enough. I encourage people to go check it out, because when you see that and you think like, would I give $8,000 in 1984 for looking at this?
Right.
But they They got $750,000, which is half the money they needed. But enough to get started.
Yeah, and I think the budget was $1.5 million.
Yeah,
and they made $3 million, so double your money.
Yeah, and they said everyone kind of, you know, usually you invest in an indie film and it's just like say goodbye to that money forever. But they said that everybody that invested made their money back and more.
Wow. I as somebody who is working on an indie documentary right now, I wish that was a reasonable promise I could make to the people who have given me money.
Not for a documentary.
No.
We all know how that works. But the cool thing is they so many firsts. Like this was Fran McDormand's first role. She was – I think they shot it. She was like 26.
She's a baby. It's amazing.
Oh, I mean, she looks so young. The Coens, not only their first movie and Barry Sonnenfeld's first movie as a DP, but Joel, and this is probably in your book too, because I think it was an excerpt from that. They said that they had never set foot on a professional movie set until they were shooting their own movie.
Yeah, I think that the only way to talk about that is just chutzpah. Like they knew that they were going to be good at this and set about to do it, and they knocked it out of the park. Like, and Barry Sonnenfeld too. Like it's beautifully shot for the, you know, like low budget that they had. They didn't have a ton of money to light this thing. So it feels like a film noir in a lot of ways, which, and like the reason film noirs are all so dark is that usually the lighting was too expensive to do extensively.
Yeah. And that was kind of the deal. They said that they didn't have any great passion for film noir, but they wanted to write, and this is really smart and good advice for up and coming filmmakers, you know, have ambition, but do something that's doable. And they, you know, they said film noir really lends itself to that because there's never more than three or four characters. They're always sort of contained.
Yeah.
You don't have to travel a lot. And most of this movie kind of takes place in the bar or in rooms or just like on the side of the highway.
Yeah. Or like if two people are in a car, like that opening conversation where they're in the car, like
God,
it's
so cool.
It's a parked car and they just are dumping enough water on the windscreen to to obscure that fact and then waving flashlights at the window to simulate passing cars.
It looked so cool, though, because it was so much rain. Like, you couldn't see anything. And then when the car, you know, the car would pass, it just, like, temporarily blinds you as a viewer.
It's also, like, a super tight script, and I think that that's another great, like, opening, you know, first film standard to set is, like, this script is a Swiss watch. Like,
yeah.
That gun, like, the math on that gun is so brilliantly done all throughout the movie. Like, you see the three bullets in the in the chamber. Mm-hmm. I don't know gun terms. Chamber?
Yeah, sure. The wheel. It's
the spinny part.
The spinny wheel.
You see the three bullets. You know that one went in to Morty. You know that one went off when John Getz kicks the gun accidentally. You
oh,
know
man.
That there's that third. You know that it's been misfired five times when Morty's in. Sorry, not Morty. Marty.
Yeah,
he plays a guy named Morty in another movie. So when Marty's in his shallow grave, he squeezes the trigger five times. So you know that when she's in the apartment at the end, like when she pulls the trigger, a bullet is going to come out of that gun.
Yeah, yeah, and you're always thinking about how many bullets are in that gun.
Like
that's one of the genius. Parts about it. Roger Ebert had this to say many years ago, which I think is pretty cool and really kind of streamlines with what you're saying there. The genius of Blood Simple is that everything that happens seems necessary. The movie's a blood-soaked nightmare in which greed and lust trap the characters in escalating horror. The plot twists in upon itself. Characters are found in situations of diabolical complexity, and yet it doesn't feel like the film is just piling it on. Step by inexorable step, logically, one damn thing leads to another. And that's kind of the deal, you know? It's like, it's a very simple movie. It's a movie about a man whose wife is cheating on him, so he hires someone to kill him, and that guy double-crosses them, and no one knows fully what's going on until it's, you know, resolved in the end.
Right. And, there are a couple of moments where characters just talking to each other about what's going on might solve a lot of their problems, but the characters are so like closed off and emotionally unavailable, and that's like well established before any of the like, hey, if you could just be open with each other,
yeah,
stuff is a problem.
That's a good point, because one of the things, like, I've seen this movie a bunch, and it does the one thing that annoys me so much in so many other movies, which is, and Emily and I are constantly yelling at movies where you're like, just say the words and solve everything. And neither one, Fran McDormand or John Getz, it would have been so easy just to say, like, I killed Marty or I didn't kill Marty.
Right.
But it didn't bother me in this movie.
It doesn't bother because John Getz's character is such a, he's such a broken guy. Like, he's in this passionate affair with Frances McDormand where they're like pulling over to stop at a motel to have sex.
Yeah.
But then when she leaves her husband and comes to his house, he's like, what do you want, the bed or the couch?
Yeah.
Like, what?
Well, it's interesting. I think that's a good point, because what I never really fully got, even after I'd seen it so many times until last night, was I don't think they were having some long-term affair. I think that might have been the first time they had sex.
Right.
If I'm not mistaken. Like, he was giving her a ride. She was complaining about her marriage. And they end up kind of pulling over and doing it, which is a big deal because they don't fully trust each other, I don't think.
Yeah. I also, like, I think that this watch through was the first time I really wrapped my mind around what a misconception he's under for the whole second half of the movie. Because when he comes back and finds Dan Hedaya dead in the office, he leaps to the conclusion that she's the one that shot him. And I think that, like, I was, you know, just not sophisticated enough to, like, project that into his head.
Uh-huh.
But it's everything that he does after that is motivated by thinking, like, oh my God, like, Abby did a murder and I'm going to clean it up and cover it up for her. This is like an act of love for him.
Totally, man. That's the whole driving force of the second half of the movie, is that he thinks she has killed him, and she starts to think that he's sort of lost it, because the bartender guy at one point even's like, you know, stay away from Ray. He's lost it. And she's like, I think Marty might be dead. Like, she doesn't even know he's dead.
He almost starts to like resent her in a way, because he's like, God, like what a horrible thing I have had to do on your behalf.
Yeah, for sure. It is horrible. So much blood.
Yeah. I mean, and I think anybody that's in a long-term relationship knows the horror of having to clean up your wife's murder victim crime scene.
It's pretty bad.
Yeah, it's tough.
What did you think? I mean, we need to talk about M. Emmett Walsh, which is, he's one of the great all-time character actors. And this, he's been great in a lot of stuff, but for my money, this may be the top of the chain for him.
He's great. And really, like, I mean, there are so many, like, I feel like he and Dan Hedaya are both, like, the kind of actor that can get real, like, my wife will never see Dan Hedaya as anything but Cher Horowitz's dad from Clueless.
Yeah, I have a hard time seeing him as anything other than Nick Bonacani from Cheers.
Right, right. My association with him is the captain of the ship in Alien 4. Because that was the first big thing I saw him in.
Wow.
But he and M. Emmett Walsh, like, are actors like that, where you know, M. Emmett Walsh, I feel like Blade Runner is like the first thing I think of when I see him. But, like, he's done a million movies. Like, his IMDb is stacked, and he's been a great, like, kind of cowboy guy, but he's done a ton of other weird roles.
Yeah, he's been in a lot of stuff. That opening narration and just that voice. The world is full of complainers. Fact is, nothing comes with a guarantee. Like, there's so many, like, the assured, not just the tightness of the script, but the assuredness of this script coming out of two guys who wrote it when they were probably 24, 25 years old is just nuts.
Voiceover is a real, you know, it's a real minefield for young filmmakers, and the Coen brothers have always known how to use it.
Totally.
It reminds me so much of the voiceover that opens No Country for Old Men, which is a similar, like, kind of Texas lawman voiceover that is almost incidental, but also, like, ties a bunch of stuff up. And I love that, like, kind of the third guy on the call sheet is the one doing the voiceover.
Oh, yeah.
You know? It's never a main character, it seems like.
Yeah, totally. And so many times, like, you were talking about the things they would revisit, like, we'll pepper those in, but I think I lost count how many times I said, Fargo.
I know.
From the opening shots of the road to, like, you know, the scene where he's pulling the body into the car when the truck is approaching, that's, like, straight out of Fargo, or the other way around, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, just the timing of, like, oh, I got to get this body back in this car so this trucker doesn't notice that I'm in the process of hiding it.
Yeah, man. And just, you know, jealous husband, cheating wife, double-crossing. It's like they're so upset, blackmail, hired killers. It's almost like Fargo feels almost like a remake at times of Blood Simple in some ways.
Yeah. What did you make of the kind of constant cutaways to ceiling fans in this movie?
Well, you know, that sound, boom, 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 boom. I think
they
had a lot.
Use it, don't they?
Oh, yeah. And, no ceiling fan on Earth makes that sound.
Use it to, like, get from one room to another. It'll be, like, at the bar. It'll like, the camera will pan up to the ceiling fan, and then it'll pan down from the ceiling fan, and it's at Ray's house or something.
Yeah, which is sort of, I mean, that's sort of student filmy. Like, I know some of this movie makes them cringe. Like, they've talked about how, you know, rough and embarrassing it is at times. But I don't know. I see it as everyone's got a first movie, and sometimes you do some obvious things like that. Like, they didn't do this shot, but when I did my short little film school stint, the teacher was like, don't ever, ever do the shot where someone walks straight into camera and then immediately cuts to their back walking away from camera. And like Scorsese does that in Cape Fear. It's like, fuck you, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, I feel like there are filmmakers that like to do the corny, obvious film school shot just to kind of like wink at the audience. But, and I also, I feel like you as an artist are always self-critical. Like this documentary I'm working on, we're in the edit right now, and most of the stuff in it I shot 5 or 6 years ago now. And I feel like I've grown so much as a filmmaker just in that 5 or 6 years that, like, looking at some of these, at these shots is like embarrassing and cringy now, and like nobody else has ever seen it.
Right.
it's just like a part of the process. You like, you grow to disdain your earlier work
or whatever you happen to be working on.
Yeah.
There was another thing that they did, another recurring thing. I'm not sure if you noticed, but the VW Beetle.
Yeah.
That's what the PI drove in Lebowski.
Right. Yeah. The private eye thing in just by itself is like such a funny obsession to have.
Yeah.
But I feel like they really have it.
Oh, for sure. I mean, how many other movies feature PIs or divorces or couples, you know? I mean, they made a whole movie about divorce and couples going at each other.
Yeah. Yeah. They're just the best. I also like that, like, Frances McDormand is not she's a really strong character, you know? Like, she's never like the damsel in distress. Like, I think a lot of the men in the movie are trying to make her that, and she is like breaking fingers and kicking balls and like stabbing guys in the hand.
Like, oh Jesus, yeah.
Like she,
yeah, I mean,
she didn't set out to do violent stuff, but she's going to protect herself at any cost. And
I mean, the scene where he goes to basically try and kidnap her away. First of all, it's a great setup seeing the dog, the German Shepherd, in the corner.
Yeah.
Like right before he attacks her. But, you know, she fucking kicks his ass. It's great. And he vomits in the front lawn because she racked him so bad.
Yeah. One thing we talk about a lot on Friendly Fire, because we watch so many war movies, there are a lot of vomit scenes.
And, oh, yeah.
The mouthful of Campbell's soup is
is
something I've railed against in the past, and this is like definitely that, just like some I don't know, cream of mushroom soup that he spits out on the grass.
Well, that's a great moment though, because he remember he gets his ass kicked and his finger bitten. He gets in the car, and you know that's when John Getz comes outside, and they're standing together, and Marty speeds off in one direction, and then you hear – it's such a Coen Brothers kind of joke in a serious scene. You hear the brakes squeak,
yeah,
and then he comes back the other way, and John Getz goes, would have liked to have seen his face when he realized it was a dead end.
I know. Like, I wondered in that moment if that was actually a dead-end street. Like, did they find that location put something into the script? Or because you don't actually see the end of the street ever. So
yeah, that's
it could
true.
Have just been in the script from jump. But it's hard to imagine thinking of a little moment like that. But it really makes the world feel real.
Yeah. And I think that's just sort of the secret that they had early on in their careers. I mean, in their mid-20s coming out of film school, to have the foresight to do like tongue-in-cheek and not take themselves so seriously. And that's when you're taking yourself really seriously, is when you make your first film, you know?
Yeah.
And they always had a sort of playful attitude about it all.
I love the dangling babe in M.M. Walsh's window.
Oh, yeah.
He like pulls the little chain down and the boobs light up.
Yeah.
like that is definitely not a pretentious film snob move to have one of your characters do that.
No, for sure. And just again with the writing, like some of my favorite lines in their movies are in this one. Early on when Marty's talking to M. Emmett Walsh and he says, don't come around here no more. If I need you, I know what rock to turn over. And then M. Emmett Walsh is just constantly laughing at everything. You know, he's basically being called a scumbag. And he doesn't get mad or anything, you know, when he says he's going to cut his head off. And he gives him a few reasons. And it's one of my favorite lines in any of their movies. He goes, give me a call if you ever want to cut off my head. I can always crawl around without it. So great, man. How do you write that line in your mid-20s?
How do you know that he's going to laugh as the last thing?
Like, yeah.
As he's bleeding out on the floor.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I mean, it's one of the best last lines of a movie ever. I mean, we don't have to wait to get there. We can go ahead and just say.
Yeah.
At the end, it's so great because the whole, not twist, but just the whole, I mean, I guess it is a twist in the end, but the whole conceit of this movie is that Fran McDormand doesn't know that he even exists.
Right. And I mean, like, it's like the 10th misunderstanding, you know, on a perfect Swiss watch of misunderstandings.
Yeah. But so she's killing
when
who
she
thinks
through
is
the
her
door,
husband.
She says, I'm not afraid of you, Marty.
So great. And he laughs and says, well, ma'am, if I see him, I'll sure give him the message. Like, as he's dying out, he realizes that she thinks he's Marty and, like, has a laugh about it. It's so fucking great.
Yeah. I feel like they, like, one of them got down on the floor of a bathroom and looked up under a sink to get that, too. Like, the, just like,
that yeah, perspective.
What would it be like to be bleeding out on the floor of a bathroom? What would you be looking at?
Yeah.
What would you see? And it's the condensation on the pipes under the sink.
Yeah. Is it going to drip? I heard a fly buzz when I died. Did you ever read that one? I think it was a poem, right?
Oh, I'm not familiar.
Yeah, there was some poem. I'll have to look it up and send it to you. But it was one of the great poems that, like, we read in English class. And it was called I Heard a Fly Buzz When I Died. And it's just that thing. Like, you're dying. You never think about the last thing you hear may not be your, you know, beloved's voice, but it may be the fucking hum of a fluorescent bulb. Or, like, somebody farting in the other room or something. It just really makes it seem so small.
That makes me think of how many times M. Emmett Walsh has a fly on him in the film.
Yeah, it's a bunch.
It happens in, like, two or three scenes where he's talking to somebody and there's a fly just, like, crawling around on his hair or something.
Were those mistakes?
I mean, I think it's one of those things where you can't control for it. So if you're shooting and there's a fly on somebody and you like it, you keep that take.
Right, but they didn't, like, have a fly wrangler and put honey on his temple or anything, right?
I can't imagine. Because
he doesn't react to it.
It's one of those things, like, a real pro actor will just power through. But also there's a scene where Marty is outside the bar sitting there when John Getz comes up to him, and there's like one of those mosquito lamps shocking mosquitoes behind him.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Bug zapper.
And they somehow got this bug zapper going, like, to punctuate what Marty is saying.
Yeah.
In a way that I feel like that you could control for. You could, like, flick a, you know, goober onto the light or something. But, like, it's interesting. I didn't know the association with that poem, and I feel like that must be intentional now that I think of it.
Maybe. I mean, that scene is really intense, and it's totally punctuated by that bug zapper going off. That's the you know what's funny scene, right?
Yeah.
You know what's really funny, and he just keeps getting more and more intense. And he basically is like – and, you know, you've seen this in movies before, but, like – the cuckolded man is like, you think you're fucking special. Like, she'll do the same thing to you. And right after that scene is when he comes home and is like, you know, you're going to sleep on the couch. Like, I think he takes a little bit of that to heart.
Right.
Come on this property again. I'll be forced to shoot you.
There's such a, I feel like no matter what, there's always like a New York guy in a Texas movie. Like, there's so many so many actors that you find like just showing up in a Western that are like, yeah I'm in the West. I'm in the West here.
Yeah, it's funny because I think I even remember the first times I saw this thinking, that's a weird thing to have Dan Hedaya in this movie because he's such a sort of Brooklyn greaseball.
Yeah.
Out in the middle of like West Texas or whatever. But, you know, who knows? Maybe he was a transplant. It was good stuff, though. He's really good in this.
Was he already famous for Cheers when this came on? I don't have my Cheers timeline figured out.
Well, this was 84, which they shot it in 82, I think. I don't think so, man. It would have been at the very beginning if that's when Cheers started.
Yeah. It's so interesting to think about that, like, because I think that is where the majority of Americans became familiar with his work. And I wondered watching it this time, because I've been like rewatching Cheers with my wife, and I wondered watching it this time, do people just see this guy as Carla's husband?
I do. Emily sees him as the clueless dad. Just like your wife, and I see him as Nick Bonacani. He had that look in Cheers. Wasn't that the deal? He had like this sexy look that he would give her and put her under a spell.
Yeah, and definitely like the same like kind of like, hey, I know it's the 80s, but I'm still wearing like kind of a 70s shirt with the buttons undone to my navel. God, he is a hairy man.
Oh, man, he is hairy. That one
the swimsuit photo is unreal.
It's a really corny looking photo too. I think they had their tongue in cheek on that one too.
Yeah, yeah.
There's so many great little sort of jokes like that, half jokes that the Coen brothers throw in there. So the scene that follows when he says, you know, I'll be forced to shoot you, is when they first set up Marty kicked back in his chair with his boots up. And the bartender comes in and goes, Marty, I thought you were dead. And that's, you know, that's how he dies. And like that shot of him just sort of not moving in that chair. I wonder how many hours he like sat there in that chair like that.
The office is such a great, it's such a great set. It's got so many, like there's, you know, two points of ingress and there's like all these dynamic versions of the lighting that we get to see, you know, whether it's night or day, there's, you know, the window into the rest of the bar. There's the safe. Like, eventually there are fish and a glass of milk on the table, which stay there for days and days, and you like the sense of how oppressive it would be in there.
Yeah,
and you know, like nobody ever like winces at the smell or anything. They're not beating you over the head with it, but you just can't help but imagine it when you see those fish.
Yeah.
And that, like, the crust starting to build up on the sides of the milk glass. What is Marty doing just, like, knocking off work and having himself a glass of milk?
Yeah.
Who does that?
That was a little weird, too. Yeah. There were a few things like that that make me think Coen brothers just have, I don't know, inside jokes between the two of them that they do. Because there's also milk in doesn't Anton Chigurh drink milk? He does.
Oh, yeah.
And No Country for Old Men.
Yeah. And the dude is always looking for milk because he's trying to make White Russians. Right. You know, he's like smelling in the milk carton.
Oh, man. I can't wait to talk about Lebowski.
At the Vons.
When he writes the check for like 69 cents or something at Vons. We got to keep our pants on, though. That's coming. So what is your take on Visser, Emmett Walsh's character, double-crossing him? Like, is the idea, you think, that he can just kill him and that's only one person he's killed, and he removes any, you know, anyone who knew that he was involved? Instead of just killing Fran McDormand and Getz?
Yeah, I think that's the idea. Like, he sees this as a cleaner way to $10,000.
Right.
Because, you know, killing two people is more than twice as complicated as killing one person. I thought a lot about this, Chuck. Yeah.
That's what it says in the handbook. Keep in mind, killing two people is twice as complicated. So he fakes these photos in whatever way you would do that in 1984. Like, there's no Photoshop. I guess he colored them in or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I wondered about that too, but you get to see the stack as he like, as he refined it when he's burning them at the end.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah. It showed it in progress, right?
Right. Yeah. And there's so much like fun photograph stuff in this movie, like all the photographs of Dan Hedaya and Frances McDormand as a couple. As a happy couple. One thing that like maybe strains credulity is the idea that they had a happy relationship for a time. Like,
yeah, I agree.
You don't see that in them necessarily in this film. Like, oh yeah, well they're mad at each other now, but they used to really love each other.
Yeah, you don't see that because she's this really young, pretty sort of pure type, and he's just this fucking scumball grease bag.
Yeah.
Greasebag scumball, whichever way you want to say it. And it's hard to even imagine them together at all, much less like happy and in love.
The photos are like the only way you can get to an idea of their marriage having been happy. But I wondered also, like, I mean, like she's not, we don't really get that much characterization with her. Like, we don't know if she has a job or has ever... gave up dreams to be with him.
Yeah.
Like, we see their house, and it's pretty nice. It seems like he's got quite a bit more in the way of resources than anyone else in the movie. Like, he's able to put a hand to $10,000. Like, that's a pretty big deal. And they do seem to have a comfortable life. So it's not inconceivable that there was kind of a social climbing element to their relationship.
Yeah, I think he's the bar owner that, you know, has more money than the bar patrons.
Right.
You know, that old deal. Because he's hitting on the girl in that one part. It's actually one of my favorite little winks as well, is when the blonde is at the bar and he's just immediately hitting on her, and she says she's an old friend of the bartender.
Yeah.
And then the end of the story, you know, it's clear that they had just met that night.
Right, right. And I love how, like, directly she shuts him down, too.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he's kind of the scumbag that's gotten used to getting his way because he's a little bit richer than everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah, for
really,
sure.
Really, it turns out to just be, like, a raging misogynist who really resents everybody that doesn't give him exactly what he wants.
Yeah, you get that idea, for sure. Well, I mean, let's talk about the burying alive sequence. That whole sequence, basically, from when Marty goes to get his back pay, I guess. I mean, not Marty, but Ray goes to get his back pay, which is, I assume, is what he's doing. All he
right.
wants
he's,
is 2 weeks.
He's going
to
go liberate his back pay from the from the cash register.
Right, which is not there. But that whole sequence from when he sees him dead and he kicks the gun, thinks Abby kills her, or killed him and tries to cover it up to the end where he ends up burying him alive. Like that sequence,
right.
The first time I saw it just blew me away.
Yeah. It's so harrowing. It's like the middle half of the movie almost.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where they kind of misdirect you enough times that you're never sure that Marty is dead entirely.
Oh yeah.
It seems like he could come back to life at any moment. And he does. Like, he's getting covered in dirt when he pulls the gun out of his pocket.
Yeah.
Which, like, I guess Ray put there just to like make the murder weapon disappear also.
I guess. I mean, I'm not even sure he fully remembered it was in his pocket because he just kind of stuck it in there to make it easier to carry him, I think.
Right.
But that's the whole horror movie motif, is the body that won't die. And they get away with doing that in this little indie kind of Texas thriller, film noir. But it's, I mean, you know, their connections with Sam Raimi were all over this movie, too.
Yeah.
Because Joel, I think, worked as assistant editor on Evil Dead. And
oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. They were old, you know, filmmaking buddies. And they straight up used Raimi tricks more than once, like the great shot early on when the camera's going down the bar and there's the drunk passed out and it goes up and over his head and back down onto the bar.
Yeah.
It's like straight up Sam Raimi. I think they put the camera on like a board or a bed sheet or something and just lifted it over by hand. something Raimi, like he used to attach cameras to boards and have people run with it, you know, all the time, very low to the ground. That was one of his, you know, yeah. big techniques.
That's rad. The that whole scene also, like, really sells how stunned Rey is. Like, he is doing this as an act of love for Abby, but he's also shocked. And
yeah.
one of the ways that that really plays for me is that he is not practicing good fingerprint hygiene.
No.
Like, he didn't walk into this expecting to be in a crime scene, and so he's, like, touching stuff. And
yeah.
It's not like super, they don't beat you in the head with it, but they do go close on his hand, like touching stuff around the room.
Oh, yeah.
And I think in later movies, they do a lot of like, here's when the police show up stuff.
Yeah.
But like, we've all seen enough, you know, crime shows and stuff to like know the implications of this. Like, he is suspect number one whenever the cops get involved on this issue. And he is like touching the safe, he's touching the post, he's touching the gun.
It's yeah, but
a big problem.
This movie sort of, now that you mentioned that, like, it kind of exists outside the law, it feels like. Like,
yeah.
at no point do you think a cop is going to show up, ever.
Right.
Like,
right.
he may be caught by a trucker on the road. I guess in Fargo, it was, well, no, that wasn't a cop either. That was just a passerby that passed by on the highway. Remember when
right.
when they saw them doing basically the same thing
right,
with
right.
Peter Stormare, but yeah, you never get, and this is sort of that cool film noir thing where people are being bad and there's no law around to stop it.
Tommy Lee Jones is nowhere in sight.
He is definitely not anywhere in sight. So he's burying him alive though in that one sequence, and the thing that really got me was when he pulled the gun out, how non-reactive Getz is and how so much tension is there, because you've counted the bullets, but there's one in the chamber, right? Somewhere.
Yeah.
Like, he could have been killed, and he doesn't like move out of the way or like leap at him. He just very gingerly takes it out of this dying man's hands who can barely even squeeze the trigger, you know?
He's squeezing the trigger with his middle finger because his,
oh, was
his
it?
Pointer finger
oh, that's right.
Is in the splint. Yeah.
Did you put your finger up the wrong person's ass? Another great line from the movie.
Yeah, like goes up to make out point to plot on a...
Yeah.
a murder with M. Emmett Walsh.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. I wanted there to be a second walk of shame when he got out of the car with M. Emmett Walsh and walked back, and people go like, what were you doing in there with him?
Did you notice Holly Hunter on the message machine?
Oh, no. Is that who that was?
Yeah, there was a phone message at one point. It was Holly Hunter because they were old friends. I think Fran McDormand and Holly Hunter were roommates, or maybe she knew Joel and Ethan, because I think they had already been friends or something, because this is where Fran and Joel like met and fell in love, basically.
Right. Yeah.
Which is a very sweet story. I read about it, actually. She said
it's
that
really sweet. Hard to imagine not falling in love with Frances McDormand.
Oh, man, totally. She showed up and had one book to read and asked him if he had any recommendations. And apparently he brought in a box of books like Raymond Chandler and all this sort of like, you know, pulp crime stuff. And she
oh,
said,
cool.
What should I read? And he said, read The Postman Always Rings Twice. And she said, that book is so fucking hot. And she said, so I read it. And we decided, I asked him if he wanted to come over and discuss the book. And for three nights, she said, we sat up drinking hot chocolate and just talking about this book. And she said, it was
wow.
so fucking hot. And she said, the secret is, she said, you got to keep it on the other side of the room for a while. So, like, they were into it, but they didn't kiss. They didn't do anything. They just, like, sat there and talked and drank hot chocolate and talked about this book. It's, like, a super sexy book.
Wow. I got to read that book now.
Yeah, they're still together, too, which is great. So, she goes to the bar. Emmett Walsh is spying on her. She still doesn't know that he exists. But
yeah.
That's when you get her coming back home, and you get that great shot of the newspaper hitting the screen door.
Right.
that slow-mo shot. It's so cool.
Just shocking when it happens, because it's like the gunshot of a newspaper hitting the door.
Yeah, but there's so many moments like that where it's just like, I don't know, just I'm so impressed that these guys with no money thought to do stuff like that. And that's the stuff that pushed it over the edge and made it win the jury prize at Sundance or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's like these little things, that these little bits of genius that they showed, like even though they didn't have any money, they could still think of a really clever, cool, effective shot like that.
Yeah, it's a big deal to get into Sundance with a movie like this too, because I think mostly with those big festivals, they want to be the world premiere, and I'm pretty sure this premiered at Toronto International Film Festival.
Yeah.
But then, like, so if you premiere at one of the other big ones, usually you're like, that was your film festival.
Right.
And hopefully you get bought there. But yeah, getting to like hit a couple of the big ones is like a really big deal. And I mean, talking about just amazing shots that they got, like when he leaves burying Dan Hedaya and he's just driving and there's just a shot out the front of the car and
yeah,
a huge flock of birds takes off.
Oh yeah.
And it's like, it's stunning. And then you see the shadows of the birds like course over the road, like two beats later. And I don't know, like, I mean, that's just one of those things that you have to be really lucky to get, but you know, right place, right time. And they got it.
Yeah, these little happy accidents.
Yeah.
There's a great article from Maxim magazine. But it was from...
I read it for the articles.
I didn't know it was still around, but this is from 2015. It was written by a guy named Callum Marsh. How Blood Simple started a 30-year Hollywood firefight. And it's a really cool article because it talks about 1982. He said that's when New Hollywood died. He talks about One from the Heart from Francis Ford Coppola, They All Laugh from Bogdanovich, Heaven's Gate, like all these really expensive bombs yeah. that went out. And this is when the Coen brothers show up. And there's a quote from it. He says... he's talking about basically where art films fit in, like in the time period. He said, you could make and in a small way circulate a thoroughly arty movie like Eraserhead or an unabashed genre picture like Night of the Living Dead or Halloween, but a weird movie right. about affairs and guns, a weird movie that was in essence still a thriller, there was no precedent. There was no Coen brothers before there was Coen brothers.
Yeah.
Like no one knew what to make of it.
A category.
Yeah, totally. I never really thought about it like that, but they are their own genre in a lot of ways.
Right. Yeah, I mean, a little less, like, specific than Wes Anderson, but in the same spirit where, like, you kind of know a lot of what it means to go out to see a Coen brothers movie.
Yeah. Emily won't see him anymore because in almost every movie they harm animals for laughs.
Wow. Yeah.
They didn't in this movie. I think they didn't start until Raising Arizona when they started blowing up bunnies and lizards in the desert. But almost every single film of theirs, whether it's Oh Brother, Where Art Thou when they're shooting the cows to, you know, No Country for Old Men, killing dogs, they do it and it's always, almost always for fun.
Well... Not a bad point. It's either Steve Buscemi or an animal that's getting it yeah. in almost every Coen Brothers movie.
My buddy worked with him, and he's a huge fan, too. He finally worked with him on, I think, Hail Caesar. And I was like, what was it like? Was it just amazing? He was like, not really. He said it was kind of a bummer because he said they're just so focused and insular. And apparently I read behind-the-scenes stuff from Emmett Walsh, how they would – apparently from the very beginning, they will go off and just huddle together, the two of them, and talk very quietly and figure stuff out and then
wow.
and then come back. And it's not like a real – it's not super inclusive and it's not like a fun light set. My friend said it's just very intense and very sort of workmanlike and They really, really, really know what they want, and that's the only thing that they want.
Yeah. I've read that they couldn't share director credit for a long time because of some guild rule. And so, like, it's Joel Coen has director credit and Ethan has producer credit on this movie, but really they're both producing and directing.
Yeah, that's always sort of been the deal. I think, I'm not sure how many movies had to do like that, but it was definitely the first handful until they finally won their grievance and the DGA acknowledged, like, yes, two people can direct a film.
It is possible for this to happen.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, you sort of get their point because it is such a, I mean, you've done it. It's a, you don't have to be an auteur, but it's usually a singular kind of vision. It's tough to co-direct, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's so interesting that siblings wind up being co-directors.
Yeah.
In that way. Like, I feel like I get it. Like, even though I'm an only child, I can imagine that, like, somebody that you can trust that much is, like, maybe the only kind of person you could do something as intense as directing a film with.
Yeah, and there's something about the sibling thing that there's no splitting it apart. Like,
right.
It even goes beyond trust. It's you and them against the world almost. It was just kind of the attitude you need when making a film, I think, in a lot of ways.
It's such an interesting thing to imagine being a young artist who is taking a $1.5 million bet on yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, with other people's money, but, like, that's, you know, that's a big swing to take. And, like, a first film is, like, I wish I had a brother to work on my documentary with.
Yeah.
You know, just like somebody to be my gym buddy. Like, and I have great collaborators on the film, but
yeah.
We're all busy people doing other stuff also. And
yeah,
it's been a side project. And it's really cool to imagine them just, like, getting this script and getting it just right and then saying, like, let's go out and make this thing.
Yeah, and with so many first-timers, beyond Fran, I read another article where they said it was the gaffer's first feature film, the sound mixer and the sound team, the boom guy's first film, Barry Sonnenfeld's first film. They, you know, they didn't know what they were doing. They just went out there. I think Sam Raimi helped out a lot with, you know, because he had already made The Evil Dead at this point. But that was...
It does not feel like a first feature from a cinematography standpoint. Like... Barry Sonnenfeld's work is really tight. Like, there are no, you know, they don't miss focus on close-ups. Like, the camera moves are all really good and well justified. The framing and blocking is beautiful. Like, it feels like a big movie.
Yeah, he was famous for throwing up from nerves on the set.
Wow.
And they said that during the filming and during dailies, they counted that he puked 18 times because he was so nervous.
Wow.
I love it. And this is Barry Sonnenfeld. I mean, the guy ended up being, like, one of the great DPs and, you know, eventually, like, a really good director too.
Yeah.
It's pretty great. So let's get to the end here with the loft sequence, which is played out in very much a Hitchcockian Rear Window sort of fashion.
Yeah.
It's so great.
It's fantastic, and like the rest of the movie, it does such a great job of just, like, you've done all the math on how this room works. You understand the geography of the space.
Yeah.
You understand, like when he reaches out the window and finds the other window, it solves a puzzle. Like, where did she go?
Uh-huh.
She went out the window and into that other window.
Yeah.
But you never see her do that.
Yeah, that's true.
They really, like, let you, like they're so confident in the math that they can let the audience do some of it themselves.
Yeah, and they very famously, the director's cut of this movie was shorter than the original cut, which you just don't ever see. You know, director's cuts usually, like, so much more indulgent. But they always thought it could have been tighter, and, like, they were just trimming scenes, and they ended up just trimming out, like, 5 minutes worth. Nothing. I don't think they even lost anything wholesale. They just, like, tighten the screws on it, which really, for young filmmakers, like, that shows a lot of poise to eschew indulgence in favor of doing something shorter and tighter at 94 minutes or whatever it was.
Yeah. And like, I think that like the most iconic shots in the movie are those bullet holes with light pouring through them.
That was in the trailer that they made. They recreated that for the movie. It looks so good.
Yeah. And when he like punches through the wall.
Yeah, man. God damn, it's great. I mean, I could never think of something that great. Dude reaches around, opens another window. Oh.
Sorry.
That's all right.
It's garbage day here.
That's all right. I like a little guest appearance. I might even leave that in there. What's your dog's name again?
That's Darwin the dog.
That's right, Darwin.
Barking at the garbage truck outside.
But reaching around that window, opening the other one, getting that hand slam and knife into it, and you just like, like my hand just started hurting describing it.
I know.
So
it's
visceral.
So rough. My wife had a hand injury early in our relationship, and she was like about ready to walk out of the room when that happened.
Oh, did she watch it with you?
Yeah.
Nice. Had she seen it before?
She mostly looked at real estate on her phone. But...
Boy, she and Emily are so much alike. To be fair, I like looking at real estate too, but you know, it's one of my passions, but still.
Got to get that Redfin app going if we're watching TV.
So yeah, stabbing through the hand, and then he's stuck there. And then the next thing, like Ebert was saying, like one thing logically leads to the next. It never feels indulgent at all.
Yeah, yeah.
He just starts shooting at her, and she's, you know, again, she doesn't run or hide in the corner. She just sort of stands there, kind of hoping that she doesn't get hit.
I mean, it's like no character is ever ducking or running in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, they, for some reason, are just too, like... I don't know. I don't know if I understand why. I don't disbelieve it though.
I know. You know, it's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty amazing.
Because that's something that would normally bother me too. Is just run the fuck out of there. Like, there's something about this movie that makes me turn my brain off of like the logical thing for someone to do, and just go with it. It's just so atmospheric and like draws you in. It's almost like a trance. It's so slow and, you know, kind of quiet.
Right.
There's not much music. The score. Oh, it was Carter Burwell's first score ever as well.
Wow.
Which, you know, they've worked with him many times over the years. But yeah, that score is just so simple. There's only one song in the movie, like popular song.
Yeah, the Four Tops, right?
Yeah, but you know the story there, right, with the I'm a Believer?
Yeah.
So the VHS version, I don't know how the rights were working or not working, but they could not use the Four Tops song. So when it came out on VHS, it was, then I saw her face, now I'm a believer.
And oh, wow.
I associate that.
I never saw the VHS version.
Well, that's all I saw, like the first four or five times I saw this movie.
So, it must have felt so wrong to you to see
really
it.
Really weird.
Yeah.
But this is the way they wanted it to be.
Yeah, a couple of times I've gotten a hold of like an early cut of a film that has like the temp tracking in it, and like you hear the songs that they had in the edit, and occasionally songs that they fell in love with in the edit and then couldn't clear, and you know it really changes the tone of a movie, like
totally.
I mean, like when we were getting Friendly Fire ready to launch, our producer Rob just found, you know, decided to put War, What Is It Good For as our theme music.
Yeah, which is perfect.
And it was just like we were, you know, getting it up on its feet, like making the show and seeing if we liked how it sounded and liked it as a show. And when we heard that music, we were like, God, that kicks so much ass. Like, we have to have that song. But how could we ever clear it?
Right.
And fortunately, we were able to find a way to do it. Like, we got in touch with the label, and they like offered us like a very reasonable price to clear it like in perpetuity as our theme song.
That's awesome.
But like, I cannot imagine that show not with War, What Is It Good For as the theme song.
No, there's no way, because it's woven through the show too. It's not just at the beginning.
Yeah.
Like, it and serves like, as all the ad stabs or whatever.
And anytime you do that in a film, it's the same thing. It's like, like it affects so much about just the meaning of a scene.
Yeah. Yeah, like you would probably be weirded out seeing it with I'm a Believer.
Yeah.
Because like, they use it
the most
times.
Beautiful Girl in the World by Prince.
Have you seen? Oh, man, that'd be really funny. But how it usually works is the song that people end up using is the one that becomes iconic, even if it wasn't the perfect song, you know, just because that's the one that they used.
Yeah, yeah. And it works, you know, it works both ways, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we kind of already talked about the end, you know, she kills who she thinks is Marty through the door. And, you know, they don't even show, again, with the sort of restraint of not explaining things. I don't even think they show her reacting much to her hearing that voice. I think she hears the laugh.
You see a little confusion wash over her face, but it's not, it's yeah, subtle. It's it. Not like she doesn't go like, huh?
Right. That's the thing, though. You're right. It is all very subtle. There's yeah. it, and that's where the movie ends with that drip down coming on him, and you get the feeling he's wondering if it's going to fall on him before he dies.
I don't love that they rock the reels a little bit. Like they're definitely like looping the droplet.
Oh,
like,
were they
playing on the edge of the pipe a little bit? It's forgivable. Like it's. But as like the last shot, like just it bumped me a tiny bit, and I was a little sad that it wasn't just perfect.
Oh, I didn't notice. So it was that little wiggle, that was the loop.
Yeah, like they play it back and forth a little bit to extend how much time it spends.
I didn't even notice
about to fall.
Gotcha. I did not notice that. I can picture you in your house, in LA going like, look, they're looping this thing. And she's like, on the Redfin app.
Yeah, a listing in San Pedro.
Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Well, that's all I got, man. You got anything else?
I don't. I really enjoyed revisiting this film. It'd been a long time since I'd seen it. And I think the last time I saw it was just on a DVD in college. So... really fun one to revisit and really cool to see these guys kind of getting their first reps as filmmakers.
Oh yeah. Like just what a great debut. I love, one of my favorite things is seeing first films of great filmmakers. And I did cover Bottle Rocket in here with someone, and I'd like to do more of those, but like the DNA of so many of their movies courses through this one. Just from the shots to the score to the, you know, to the themes and some of the characters even. It's really, really cool.
It's great. Thank you so much for having me to talk about it, man.
Yeah, dude.
This
was
a treat.
Are we going to cover all of these movies?
Hell yeah.
I think we have to over time. I mean, it might take us a year.
Yeah. Or yeah. More. The Coen brothers have a pretty deep catalog at this point.
Yeah. Here's the thing, though. I've already done Raising Arizona and Miller's Crossing.
Okay.
Sadly.
We could skip to Barton Fink then?
Is that the next one?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Barton Fink, Hudsucker Proxy, and Fargo, the next three. And then Lebowski.
God, I can't believe Fargo was that early. It seems like that seems so later Coens to me.
Yeah, it's 12 years after Blood Simple, but... It's still closer to that than now.
Yeah. Yeah, Barton Fink, very big movie for me for a lot of reasons, which we'll talk about in a couple of months.
Looking forward to it.
All right, thanks, Ben. And if you haven't seen Blood Simple, fully encourage you to go out and check it out. They have a Criterion edition that you can get on iTunes and I think elsewhere.
Yeah.
It's a nice transfer. I think it's 60mm film, right? It's got to be.
It's 35mm print that they scanned it from. And they scanned it 4K, but I don't think that that's available for digital download. I think it might be available on like Blu-ray or something, but But it's a really nice print that they worked from, and they like recolor graded it and stuff, and that was all supervised by Barry Sonnenfeld.
Yeah.
So it's like they really did it right.
Awesome. All right, good stuff, Ben.
Later, dude.
Talk to you soon, brother.
Bye.
All right.
Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.